From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On this archive edition of Fresh Air, actress Jenna Rollins. For 30 years, she collaborated with film director John Cassavetes, her late husband. Her new film, Unhook the Stars, which opens today, was directed by their son, Nick Cassavetes. Also on this Valentine's Day, trying to be friends with an ex-lover. We showcase a story from the public radio program This American Life, as told by the host himself, Ira Glass. And film critic John Powers reviews Clint Eastwood's new movie, Absolute Power. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The federal mediator who is working with negotiators for American Airlines and its pilots union says he is somewhat encouraged by the nonstop talks, but with only 12 hours left before the strike deadline, the head of the pilots union says he sees no agreement in sight. More from Dave Mattingly.
Travelers booked on American Airlines flights are scrambling, with the strike deadline now just hours away. The airline has canceled about a dozen domestic round-trip flights today, and most international ones. And there's no sign of any imminent breakthrough in the talks. Company spokesman Tim Smith says the union's latest proposal, calling for its pilots to fly the airline's new regional jets at a lower cost, a key issue in the talks, is inadequate.
While it may well be lower costs on the part of our pilots, it is nowhere near the cost that we need to be competitive, which is essentially to fly those smaller jets with our commuter airline affiliate.
Smith speaking on ABC. Both sides are negotiating with the help of a federal mediator. President Clinton has so far given no indication that he plans to step in to prevent a pilot walkout. I'm Dave Mattingly in Washington.
A final decision on who should control the contested Bosnian city of Brčko has been put off for at least a year. In the meantime, the city will remain in the hands of the Bosnian Serbs, although an international supervisor with police powers will be appointed to oversee the city. NPR's Silvia Poggioli says the ruling, announced today by an American mediator, has been greeted with a range of reactions.
The reactions here in Brčko on the Serb side, which Brčko is under Serb control now, are muted. But I think they're rather satisfied, although they're very concerned about the problem about resettlement of refugees here. On the other side, where the Muslims are who want to come back, there's a great deal of anger. There was leaks were coming out yesterday that the decision was not going in their favor. About 1,000 Muslims rallied at the nearby American base last night and accused the United States of being traitors. Today, a rally is being planned on the other side by the Muslims on the other side, and we will see what happens. There's a lot of tension here.
NPR's Silvia Poggioli reporting. A Colorado judge is expected to rule by the end of the day on whether the autopsy report in the JonBenet Ramsey murder case will be made public. Prosecutors say release of that report would hinder their investigation. On this Valentine's Day, the National Organization for Women is sponsoring demonstrations in support of same-sex marriages. Now President Patricia Ireland says the events will include mock wedding ceremonies and the sending of Valentine postcards to lawmakers. Demonstrators also plan to picket in front of the Washington Post building in the nation's capital. Ireland says the newspaper has refused to print paid announcements about same-sex commitment ceremonies. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 13.5 points. This is NPR News. Now an NPR's business update. Wholesale prices have posted their biggest monthly decline in more than 2 years. The Labor Department says its producer price index fell 0.3% last month. Lower costs for heating oil, meat, and passenger cars helped lead the downturn. A 3-week carnival is underway in Havana. The festivities have been held annually since the onset of the economic crisis in Cuba, brought on by the collapse of the Soviet Union. As the BBC's Tom Gibb reports, the carnival reflects the growing importance of tourism to the Cuban economy.
Some kind of carnival on the island dates back for centuries, but it was suspended during the economic collapse at the beginning of the decade. Since its revival last year, it's no longer provided free by the state. Indeed, like so many things in Cuba now, it's expected to pay its way. Entrance fees are being charged for the main events as well as for street dances. The beginnings of economic recovery in Cuba have been fueled by the creation of a tourist industry and increased foreign investment. The island had 1 million visitors last year. At present, the carnival is a much smaller event than before the revolution, when it was one of the Caribbean's major attractions. But in the future, the organizers hope to expand it, perhaps with foreign sponsorship.
The BBC's Tom Gibb. A report from the Federal Reserve suggests moderate economic growth. The Fed says production at the nation's factories, mines, and utilities was unchanged last month. The report also indicates restrained price pressures. The company that makes Yale locks is buying a security and fire protection firm. Britain's Williams Holding says it will pay about $2.1 billion for Chubb Security, which mainly operates in Britain and Asia. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News.
Support for this program comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, supporting public understanding of technology, industry, and economic growth.
Fresh Air support comes from William Morrow, publishers of Even the Wicked, the new Matthew Scudder mystery novel by Lawrence Block.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Jenna Rollins is a great actress who is revered in the world of independent cinema. She was a pioneer of independent cinema, along with her late husband, John Cassavetes, the screenwriter, actor, and director. He died in 1989. Rollins starred in several of Cassavetes' films, including A Woman Under the Influence, A Child is Waiting, Faces, Minnie and Moskowitz, and Gloria. Her new film opened nationally today. It's called Unhook the Stars, and it was directed and co-written by her son, Nick Cassavetes. Rollins plays a suburban widow and mother of two children. Her son is married, her teenage daughter is in a period of rebellion and has left home in anger. Feeling alone and useless, Rollins becomes the full-time babysitter for the boy next door, whose own mother, played by Marissa Tomei, can't afford daycare while she works. In this scene, Tomei has taken Rollins out for a drink and a game of pool at the neighborhood bar.
What's the deal with your daughter?
Why does she hate you so much?
Oh,
I don't think she hates me, really. We're just so different. She's right at that age I can't stand. She hates being told what to do. She does everything wrong. I don't blame her, really. I've always preferred my son. Anybody could tell that.
What are you telling me? You like your son the best? Doesn't that violate a mother code? Aren't you supposed to like all your kids the same?
Yeah. But you never do.
Jenna Rollins, welcome to Fresh Air. I want you to describe the mother that you play in Unhook the Stars.
Well, she is a Midwesterner, a woman who has been very happy in her marriage and the raising of her children. She's a woman who hasn't had any other kind of work. And then she suddenly finds herself in the position of her husband is dead and her children are grown and out on their own, and she hits that wall of thick air that she just doesn't know whether she's coming or going, even though she's not a woman that panics easily. I think it's a feeling that men get when they retire from work. That's where she finds herself at the opening of the picture.
What did you feel you had in common with her, and what did you perhaps not relate to after raising three children yourself? But of course, you've also had a celebrated career.
I can't say that, of course, that my life is like Mildred's, because, as you say, I've always worked, I've always been an actress, and it's a very different kind of life. But I have had children, I have loved a man, I have lost a husband, and my children have, you know, moved out and grown up and gone off on me. And then I would think the most autobiographical part would be the relationship of Mildred, the character that I play, with the little boy across the street that it was Marissa Tomei's son, who I start taking care of for her while she's working and separated from her husband.
What was autobiographical about that?
The relationship between Mildred and the little boy was much as mine was with my son when he was little.
Well, one of the wonderful things about the mother Mildred in Unhook the Stars, she's the kind of mother who knows how to provide structure and protection for a child, how to, you know, read to him and just make every little thing in the world seem like there's an interesting story behind it, finding just like a safe, structured place for a child. Were you that kind of mother who really knows how to do that? Not every mother does.
Well, I don't know. I do have to admit that I read that encyclopedia to him.
like the mother in the movie does.
Yes, which is some embarrassment to me now, because I got on the set and I said, Nick, this child is pretty, you know, little to be reading an encyclopedia to. And he said, are you kidding me? He said, you read me that encyclopedia all through my childhood. And, you know, I had honestly forgotten. But I plead mother madness because, you know, when you're a young mother and you have a child, you want to teach him every single thing in the world. And I guess it makes a certain sense to start from A and go to Z in the encyclopedia, but it's a pretty heavy trip, too.
Jenna Rollins is my guest, and she's starring in the new movie Unhook the Stars. Now, I'm thinking about another role that you played in which there was... you played a mother figure, not exactly a mother. I'm thinking of Gloria, your 1980 mm-hmm. movie, which Sharon Stone is remaking. I love...
That's what I hear.
Yeah, I love this movie, Gloria. You play a woman who used to be connected to the mob.
Uh-huh.
And you're asked by neighbors who know that they're about to be executed by the mob to take care of their 6-year-old son. Now, the mob is going to be after the son, too, because the parents have given the son the books that they kept on the mob business. Now, your character, Gloria, doesn't think she has any maternal feelings, and she wants to ditch the kid. But when she's standing on the street and the mob guys come to get the kid, she blows them away, and then she and the kid really start to bond. How did you play the mother figure differently in both of these roles? You know, in one, you're this, like, really tough gun-toting woman, and in the other, you're, you know, a Middle Western woman who has been a homemaker all of her life.
I think that the maternal instinct was as great a surprise to Gloria as anything ever could have been. I think it was instinctive. It just that desire to protect a child that a woman has, and probably men have too. And also, she realized they were going to kill him. She wasn't shocked or surprised by it. She knew them. She'd been there in association with them, and she just couldn't let it happen.
Gloria was, in a way, really out of character film for you. It's an action film in a way, and you're pretty handy with a gun in the film. Not your typical role. Did you enjoy that change of pace?
I loved it. It was such a fantasy. I mean, it's essentially here I am, and I'm going to take on the whole mafia and beat them. You know, which is sort of an incredible power trip.
While being very motherly at the same time.
While being very motherly at the time. But I remember it was so strange carrying that gun at first. And then after a while, because I always carried it in my purse, so I could shoot through the purse if I needed to. Gloria, I'm speaking of, not me. And then afterwards, I was carrying the purse, because, you know, the prop man comes and takes it from you so there won't be an accident or anything at every occasion. And then all of a sudden, my purse would seem very light. And I thought, my, you get used to things very quickly and depend on things very quickly. It was, the whole thing was, and it was a tough picture physically because I was running around those 4-inch heels, sandals, and carrying the child over my shoulder and running through Harlem in, you know, 98 degrees heat and 1,000 humidity or something, so that it was a picture you got into shape very quickly.
A Woman Under the Influence, directed by your late husband, John Cassavetes. You played a woman married to a character played by Peter Falk. And you're having a nervous breakdown, and you just, like, unravel more and more as the movie goes on. Had you seen somebody going through that before taking on the role? Somebody who you could think about while doing the movie?
Not one person. You know, I wasn't thinking of one person, but I have seen people who so loved another person that it became an obligation to the other person. It wasn't a wonderful thing, and the person who loved too much developed nothing else in her life, so that when that love was withdrawn from her, that she had nothing to fall back on. I have seen that several times.
And how did you use that in the movie?
Well, just you think you study your part. I mean, just the way you would think that you do. A part is like reading a detective story. You are presented with. You don't write it. You don't start it in the middle. You interpret it, and very often you find things that they're doing, the character that you're doing that puzzles you, and you wonder how and why, and so you take as much of, because I believe that all of us have every quality, all of us. It's a matter of degree, and acting is a matter of increasing the degree or decreasing. But it's always there, and you can always find it inside of you. It's just a matter, very often, of just sitting for quite a long time and thinking about things. And if, when you come to something that is extremely puzzling, to figure it out and think about things that you've seen and heard and people you've known. And all you need is just a little. It can be like a little piece of rice, but once you have the feeling, then you can enlarge it and take it where you wish to.
Were you enlarging on your own insecurities when playing the role in A Woman Under the Influence? And if so, if you have to draw on your own feelings to do that, did you feel in a very vulnerable state while making the movie?
It's strange that I did feel in a very vulnerable state, but I wouldn't say that that part is very like me, which is puzzling in a way because it affected me very deeply. I walked a little closer to the line than perhaps I should have in that, because it remained with me for a long time after the movie was over. I could hardly see a woman, you know, waiting for her children at a school bus without my eyes filling up with tears, or a woman walking along talking to herself, which you see so often, so very often. And then I would think of Mabel, and I'd miss her. You know, when you play a lot of characters, even though you're finished with them at the end of the movie, they don't ever really go away. They're always in your head and in your emotions, and you wonder what happened to them, what they're doing now, and you know how things worked out. It's sort of like a novel that you never quite get out of.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jenna Rollins, and she's starring in the new movie Unhook the Stars, which is directed by her son, Nick Cassavetes. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Jenna Rollins. She's starring in the new movie Unhook the Stars. Could you describe a little bit about what the guidelines for improvisation were within the films that you made with John Cassavetes? How much improvisation was there? What were the parameters for that?
The first film that he made, Shadows, was entirely improvised. I wasn't in that. And so then he did develop a reputation from that as as doing everything improvisationally. But actually, after that, he always had a script, and not just a thrown together script, a real script. But then, when we would have, if you'd have a problem with a scene, or John's theory was that if he got a bunch of good actors together and there was a problem, that it was the writer's problem. So then we would stop and we'd talk about it, rehearse, improvise, work about it as much as we needed to. And then when we thought we had it, he'd go in and sit down and write the scene from the improvisation the way he wanted it. And that's how we did most of them. Not all of them. There were lots of improvisations all the way through to the last films that we made. But mainly they were very scripted.
And so even the parts that were improvised, by the time you did the final take, it had been scripted based on the improvisation.
Mostly. I was thinking of one that is just the opposite of that. In our last picture, Love Streams, I played a woman who loved too much, loved her husband too much, loved her children too much. I did everything too much. I carried too much luggage. And I believed that love was a stream that could never, ever stop. And this I believed in spite of the fact that my husband just couldn't stand me. And my child was just right along his side because she just drove everybody crazy with her excessiveness. It says in the script that she calls the husband home from a business meeting and the child home from school because she knows that they are not getting enough fun out of life and that they are wasting their time with this sort of thing. So they come home thinking something important is happening. And then there's just this one little sentence, really, and it said, they come home and sit down, she makes them laugh. And I said, what does that mean, John? And how does she make them laugh? He said, don't worry about it. He said, I've got something great planned. You're going to love it. And I said, well, but do you have any hints or anything? He said, no. He said, I don't want to ruin it for you. He said, just wait. And I said, this is making me hysterical. And he said, no, I'm telling you. He said, I don't want to even give it away. So we got to the day that we were going to shoot, and he said, stay in the dressing room. I don't want you to see the preparations. And I really was truly hysterical. And finally he came and said, okay. He said, now come on out. And we were shooting in the backyard of this beautiful home. And there was Seymour Cassell and Risa Bluett, who were playing my husband and child. And they're both sitting there. And they had a long picnic table. And on top of the picnic table, there were about 100 of those, you know, those crazy little games that you see, you know, those clattering, chattering false teeth and eyes that pop out on springs and ketchup bottles that look like they're getting stuff all over you. All that terrible, those joke store games. And John said, there, what do you think? I said, what do you mean, what do I think? Well, what am I supposed to do here? He said, make them laugh. I said, with these, which ones? He said, all of them. He said, we've got a minute to shoot it. He said, and use every one, make them laugh, and then go jump off the diving board into the pool. So I said, well, shall we rehearse? He said, no. He said, I don't want to ruin the spontaneity of it. He said, okay, roll them. And so I just wildly started, you know, with the eyes and the ketchup and the thing. And of course, he had already told them not to laugh because in their characters, they were not amused that they'd been brought home, you know. And so now I got wilder and wilder, trying, you know, just anything to. And finally, the minute had gone by, and I went and jumped off the diving board. Then, of course, I realized why I was jumping off the diving board, because he had it planned that they weren't going to laugh. Now that kind of improvisation was quite rare, because there was no rehearsal, there was no talking, there was nothing. It was just, you just went for it. And it, you know, he was right. It was more fun to do that scene. It's when I look back on it with a lot of happiness.
Do you feel that your acting approach or the kinds of films that you're doing now have changed since the death of your husband in 1989?
Well, sure. In the first place, John wrote very great parts for me, and I'm a very lucky actress to have had so many, because an actress can go a whole lifetime. If you get one or two wonderful, really wonderful parts, you can consider yourself a lucky actress. And I had many more than that. And believe me, I'm grateful for it. And then now I look in parts for something. You know, when you first start out, everything is interesting to you because you haven't done anything. All the parts seem interesting to you. And then you've done that, you've done that, and you've looked into that. And so you keep looking for new things that to explore and to think about. And I like to do modern parts rather than classic parts. I think we live in such a, you know, a fascinating time, and with all of the rules changing and everyone trying to change with them and figure out what's right and what's wrong, it's a period that I want to be involved in. And so I look for parts that I haven't done and that will reveal something to me that I haven't worked on. Or I'll work on something because I especially like I did something to talk about, because I wanted to work with Bobby Duvall. I love him, and he's a wonderful actor, and I've never worked with him, and we had, you know, a couple of really funny, nice, light comedy scenes, and I don't very often play light comedy. So there are all kind of reasons that I look for a part now.
Jenna Rollins, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Jenna Rollins recorded last November. Her new film, Unhook the Stars, opened nationally today. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on this Valentine's Day, reuniting with your old flame and trying to be just friends. Ira Glass tells us how it worked for him as we showcase another story from the public radio program This American Life. Also, film critic John Powers reviews the new Clint Eastwood movie Absolute Power. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Valentine's Day is an occasion when two friends might become two lovers. We have a story about some of the complications when the plot heads in the other direction and two ex-lovers try to be friends. The story is told by Ira Glass, the host of a public radio series we like to showcase on Fresh Air called This American Life, produced at WBEZ in Chicago. The theme of this edition was Get Over It.
Well, it was Danielle's cousin Lynn who said it best. She said that Danielle and I had put ourselves into the kind of situation that 1,000 comedies had been built on. Situation comedies, screwball comedies, every kind of TV, theater, movie, drama thing. We had done that. We had done that to ourselves. And how did we not know? Here we were, Danielle and I. We used to be involved, and it was our first time together as just friends. Just friends. Just friends. You know you're in trouble when the word just appears in front of the word friend. I mean, it's almost hard to think of a context where those two words are used together. A sentence constructed, unless using the word just in some radically different way, like, I think the verdict was just, friends may disagree. Like, if they have nothing to do with each other, maybe it's okay. But. Because automatically, you know, it implies a negotiation's happening. Just friends. Friends is like a state of being. Friends is like, you know, there's a road, there are houses, people are friends, you know? So when you put just in front of it, it suggests the imbalance. And that's where you get the screwball comedy aspect. All right, I'm going to try to keep the mundane personal information to a minimum here so we can focus on the bigger universal truths this story may offer. Briefly, some facts, though. Okay, Danielle and I had been broken up for half a year. And she lived in New York City, I lived in Chicago, and we talked on the phone several times a week. In other words, that kind of weird post-relationship situation where, you know, there's no more sex, but you sort of depend on each other for all your emotional needs. So, you know, kind of all the work of the relationship, but none of the sheer physical pleasure. That was our thing. Anyway, so 2 days before I came to New York City to visit friends there, real friends, not just friends, just normal friends. And Danielle, she informs me that there's a guy that she had started dating. I like him, she said. I really like him. And then, 2 days later, I found myself in New York City. And, you know, your wish in this kind of situation is you want a sense of, okay, we're going to be friends, it's going to be okay, we're going to see how this new thing between us feels. And we're trying to hang out and be buddies, you know. And that's how we ended up in Saks Fifth Avenue, where the first moment of our screwball comedy weekend occurred. So, you know, we're walking through that big, cold floored Fifth Avenue store and the mannequins everywhere and Anne Klein and Anne Klein 2 and Anne Klein Contemporaries. There are actually three different Anne Klein departments at Saks Fifth Avenue and all the other designers. And it wasn't too crowded and it wasn't too empty. And she was walking ahead of me, just a step or two ahead of me, never quite meeting my eye. And I realized, oh, that's why this has been for like an hour or two, isn't it? When we were walking up the street, it was like that. She wasn't quite meeting my eye. She wasn't quite talking to me. It's like she's holding a certain emotional distance. You know, Valentine's Day is coming up this week. And in each of our histories of love, who has not played both parts in this drama, you know? Both parts. Who hasn't been both people in this picture at one time or another? The person walking a little briskly ahead, not meeting the eye of the other person, and the person walking behind, you know, a little over-eager, a little extra edge of anxiousness, wanting to make the connection, a little bit like an eager puppy. The other person ahead, a little bit put off by the yapping of this puppy, no matter how subtle and dignified and interesting that yapping happens to be, just kind of not wanting to just deal with this, not wanting to face this situation, walking ahead about three paces. Who among us has not been on both sides of that?
We'll get back to Ira Glass's story after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to Ira Glass's story about becoming just friends with an ex-lover.
So she's looking for clothes. And she has this new guy she's seeing. And she's carrying the clothes. And we're looking for a dressing room. And we find a dressing room. And we stand outside the dressing room. And it's an automatic setup situation. Do I come into this dressing room and watch you try it? She's like, I want you to see these clothes. Okay. Do I come into the dressing room? There's something inherently odd and awkward about not coming in. Because, I mean, what is in there that I have not seen before? But there's something inherently awkward about coming in as well. You know, because things have changed. Either way, there's a problem. So we stood there in the door, on the door of this dressing room, and composed the orbits that were riding against each other, right? We looked at the two little orbits and decided, okay, I'll go in. And she takes off her clothes and tries on these clothes. And the clothes she has gotten are the following. There is a little lacy, clingy sort of stretch top of black, kind of like a black lace thing, you know, that you would wear maybe a jacket over to cover your nipples. And so she's got that on. And she's got this little mini skirt. And while we've been walking around Saks, she's been saying, you know, I've got to find a mini skirt. I really need a black mini skirt. She just switched jobs. And so she's trying on this mini skirt, and it's she's looking very cute. She's looking adorable, you know? And suddenly she's trying on the mini skirt. So we say, honey, you know, you have a mini skirt. You have that black pleated mini skirt. I've seen you in that mini skirt a million times. She says, No. I don't. That mini skirt comes down to here, and she indicates a spot maybe an inch above her knee. I need a mini skirt that's a lot shorter. I need it to come to here. She indicates a spot maybe, I don't know, 6 inches, 8 inches above her knee? 6 inches? A lot higher. And there's a pause. And she looks at me and says, well, I wouldn't wear this to work. So I start to think to myself, what am I doing here? Who are these clothes for? And I picture the guy who she's going out with. And I picture pretty much him looking at the clothes, her trying to look cute in the clothes, her looking very cute in the clothes. I pretty much kind of picture everything you can kind of picture.
And I said, I'm sitting down on the chair, this little chair in the dressing room. And so there's Danielle, looking adorable in her little clothes and kind of absorbed and looking at it this way and that. And I'm going to try to describe the gesture that occurs next. Imagine me, a tallish sort of guy, slumped in this chair, sort of leaning back in this chair in this dressing room. And I hope I can convey this over the radio, what the motion she does next. I had been feeling like she kind of wasn't seeing me. You know, when we were walking around the store, I felt a little bit ignored, like not seen. And I'm sitting in the dressing room thinking, you know, I should really leave this dressing room. I don't really need to see this right now. And just as I'm thinking this thought, she takes off the miniskirt and she just kind of tosses it onto the chair as if it were an empty chair. But in fact, I'm sitting on it. So she just tosses the skirt onto me. And suddenly she looks up and in horror, actually, I have to say, to her credit, in actual horror, and sees the skirt kind of sitting on my chest because I'm slumped backwards. And so there's this sort of semi-horizontal surface and this skirt is now sitting on my chest. Looking ridiculous. And suddenly she realizes exactly what she's done. And she says to me, oh no.
You're going to talk about this on your radio show, aren't you? Well, of course, this is my radio show. And by the way, I did get Danielle's permission to talk about this on the radio. Otherwise, it would not be here talking about it with you today. And I bring up what happened between me and Danielle because I think that she and I stumbled upon a few things that happened universally in the get over it situation. For one thing, one of the most delicate aspects of this situation is how much information do you want about your ex-girlfriend's new boyfriend, you know, or your ex-whatever's, you know, new whatever. My friend Julie told me a story in Warning that went as follows. She had hungrily devoured every piece of information she could get about one of her ex-boyfriend's new girlfriends. And at one point he told her that the girl had a dog. And somehow that detail made Julie crazy. It made her feel like, oh my God, this is a person with her life worked out completely. This is a person whose life is so much better than mine. This person has a dog, which means that they have a life that can surround a dog. And the fact that they have a dog means that they're a person capable of love. And it means that they're a person in a stable situation with a home where they can have a dog. And suddenly everything came into question about him and her and the girl. And I wanted to avoid that. But I wanted information. And I don't know exactly why, but there was a powerful herd of stampeding horses within me wanting information. And I found myself asking questions. And I know, listen very carefully to these questions. Listen very carefully, Ira, because whatever it is that you're asking will indicate something about yourself, and the order you ask them will indicate something. You can learn something here. And I listened to this. I said to myself, okay, how old is he? And he's 28. And okay, that one made sense. It kind of, the age difference between Danielle and I had been kind of a big issue, and so I was trying to gauge kind of where this new guy fit into the geography of that old familiar landscape. See, that's part of what this is about. You know, you have this map of an emotional city that you've built with another person, and you want to figure out, well, where are they on the map now, you know? So my second question was going to be, so what's he do? What's he do for a living? Like, you know? But you know how every now and then you'll read an article or somebody at a party will say, you know, isn't it shallow? They'll say, isn't it shallow? Isn't it shallow that when people want to know about other people, the first question they ask is, what do they do for a living? Isn't that so shallow? Doesn't that indicate what a shallow group of people we are? And I thought, you know, I don't want to fall into that trap. You know, I don't want to fall into that trap of just equating people with their jobs. You know, you don't want to think we are our jobs. You know, that's just a shallow. So I sort of thing. So I sidestep that question.
and came up with another question. The question I found myself asking, I don't know where this came from, was, is he a Jew? I've been to services, what, once in the last 15 years? Is he a Jew? I think what I meant by it was, is he a member of my tribe? Is he like me? Is he like me, honey? Honey, you're seeing somebody else. Is he like me? He must be like me if you're seeing him, right? The only person you could be interested in is me, so he must be like me. He was not a Jew. Now, I would like to tell you, beloved radio listener, that this phase of jealousy and competitiveness passed quickly on my part, that I moved with grace and ease into the world of just friends. I would like to say that. But, you know, one of the rules of getting over it, in fact, maybe the main rule of getting over it, is that you cannot choose the time and place. You know, you cannot will it to happen. You cannot think, okay, now, I have the right attitude right now. I'm over it. I'm ready. I'm over it. And it's now. It's like, it's like when Jesus returns. I say this to you as a Jew. It's like when Jesus returns, you know, none will know the exact day or hour. It can come like a thief in the night, the getting over it.
Ira Glass is the host of the public radio series This American Life, which we showcase from time to time on Fresh Air. The series is produced at WBEZ in Chicago and heard on many public stations around the country. We like to play a good love song each Valentine's Day. Here's a lyric that says it all.
Blah, 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 moon. Blah, blah, blah. Blah, 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 croon. Blah, 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 love. Tra-la-la-la, la, tra-la-la-la-la, la, la, merry month of May. Tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la, la, la, neath the clouds of gray. Blah, 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 your hair. Blah, 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 your eyes. Blah, 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 care. Blah, 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 skies. Tra-la-la-la, tra-la-la-la-la, cottage for two. Blah, 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 darling, with you.
That's Rebecca Kilgore with Dave Frischberg at the piano from Kilgore's brand new CD, Not a Care in the World, on Arbor's Jazz. On some archive edition in the near future, we'll rebroadcast her Fresh Air concert. Coming up, John Powers reviews Clint Eastwood's new film, This is Fresh Air. Clint Eastwood made his mark as a movie star, but is increasingly being recognized as a film director. He won an Oscar for directing the Western Unforgiven. His new movie, coming off the success of The Bridges of Madison County, is a political thriller called Absolute Power. John Powers has a review.
25 years ago, if you'd asked which Hollywood star was going to wind up with the most interesting career, almost no one would have named Clint Eastwood. But while Nicholson, Beatty, Redford, and Hoffman all became congealed in their fame, Eastwood became the first star in Hollywood history to do braver work in his 50s and 60s than he'd done in his youth. He's an icon who made himself an artist. His latest directorial effort, Absolute Power, is a real treat. Eastwood stars as Luther Whitney, a master thief who decides, as a last hurrah, to rob a billionaire's mansion. But in the midst of the burglary, Luther witnesses something strange. A sex murder involving the billionaire's wife and the President of the United States, who's played by Gene Hackman. Luther wants to flee. He's in over his head. But he stays around because he's trying to reconcile with his daughter, Kate, played by Laura Linney, who feels he's always abandoned her. And so Luther spends the rest of the movie being hunted by Secret Service men, by a hitman hired by the vengeful billionaire, and by homicide detective Seth Frank, played by Ed Harris. Seth's a wry, decent man who keeps playing cat and mouse with Luther, as in this marvelous scene when the two first meet in a cafeteria.
Would you like a signed confession now, or would you like to have a little coffee first?
Before I send you away for life, I should probably check out your alibi.
I was watching a football game with an old friend of mine, Red Bransford. He owns a saloon here in town. You can ask me about the game if you'd like. I could be lying.
You've been following the case?
Yeah, I have. I love true crime.
The FBI says there's only a few guys who could have handled something as refined as the Sullivan job. I got a list here. You're on it.
Oh, I wish it were true. This person, they go in the front door, and then they go out a window and down a rope in the middle of the night. If I could do something like that, I'd be the star of my AARP meetings.
I've already read some reviews which fault Absolute Power for being implausible and insufficiently knuckle-biting. But even though the opening murder scene is a tour de force, such criticisms miss the point. This movie isn't a straightforward thriller. Rather, it belongs in the genial tradition of Hitchcock's North by Northwest or Howard Hawks' Rio Bravo, autumnal works which play with movie conventions. Although the story is astonishingly cynical, the president's a killer, a woman beater, and a betrayer of his oldest friends, this political corruption clearly doesn't engage Eastwood, whose sense of outrage largely vanished with Dirty Harry. In fact, he treats the political skullduggery here as social comedy, making hilarious use of Judy Davis as the president's bitchy chief of staff. Far from being obsessed with the machinery of suspense, Eastwood handles the thriller elements cavalierly, as they did in old movies like The Scarlet Pimpernel. He puts his real energy into exploring the human relationships that thrillers usually ignore. As the movie progresses, Luther's love for his daughter Kate goes from being a dreary cliché to something genuinely felt, especially in a couple of delicately magical scenes involving Kate's empty refrigerator. Eastwood also returns to a favorite theme, the precariousness of honorable manhood. We can see the ideas of honor at work in all the male characters, most interestingly in Detective Frank, who's looking for love at least as much as he's looking for the killer. He's played with relaxed charm by Harris, a wonderful actor who's usually asked to do little more than clench his jaw. Naturally, the movie is dominated by Eastwood, and like all his movies, Absolute Power offers a commentary on the star himself. As Luther, he plays a crack thief who attempts one more big score, almost whimsically, out of love for the craft. He doesn't really need the money and is actually happier spending his days at the National Gallery, sketching the faces in old master's paintings. It's hard not to see this as a metaphor for Eastwood's own artistic situation. He too doesn't need any more money or fame, and if he keeps making Hollywood movies, it's because he too loves the craft of it. Like his alter ego Luther, Eastwood actually cares less about some imaginary big score than perfecting the art of making human faces come alive.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. We'll close with the anthem of the day, sung by Tony Bennett.
You're my funny Valentine, sweet comic Valentine. You make me smile with my heart. Your looks are laughable, unphotographable, yet you're my favorite work of art. Is your figure less than Greek? Is your mouth a little weak? When you open it to speak, are you smart? But don't change a hair for me, not if you care for me. Stay, little Valentine, stay. Each day is Valentine's Day.
Tony Bennett with Ralph Sharon at the piano. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Alan Tu directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publishers of Nothing But You, Love Stories from the New Yorker, edited by Roger Angel. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the woman who helped transform the Washington Post into one of the nation's most respected newspapers, former Washington Post publisher Katherine Graham. She's written her autobiography. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.